Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. As always, I am your host, Robert Jean Pelleccio. Mixing up the format a little bit this month, we have not one, but two playwrights, both based in Philadelphia. In a little bit, we will be talking to playwright Lisa Villamil about her play Salamander. But first, we are talking to another Philadelphia-based playwright, Davey Stranton White, with his play Girl with Airplane. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, just to get the ball rolling to start us out, can you please share a little bit about your theater background?
Yeah, I enjoyed writing as a youngster and was encouraged to write a lot of stuff, and I had planned to go to college for writing, but then the very last minute I said, you know what, it's a theater life for me, and I went in with very little experience to become a theater major at Purdue University, and
oh, as the road twists and turns as it does.
Yeah. and I was advised to start out as an acting major. So I did. And I sort of really enjoyed that part of the theater collaboration and stuck with that for, you know, a really long while. I went to grad school. I was an equity actor. And then little by little, I got back into writing, mostly because I would participate in new play workshops and realize that I couldn't keep my mouth shut. And the advice for actors in new play workshops who talk too much is you should write your own play. So I'm like, yes, I absolutely should.
I wonder sometimes, and the people who give that advice, I wonder how many people are pushing for a career path and how many people are incredibly ironic. Oh, you know so much. Why don't you write a play?
Well, yeah, and I mean, looking back, I don't know who said that to me, and whoever said that was kind of rude or kidding, but
it's a very, very fine line.
Yeah, or both. Yeah, rudely kidding, but yeah. So I started writing my own plays, and when my first one was produced, I was just like, man, this side of the table feels really good to me, and I couldn't, you know, I really enjoy the feeling of breaking through a scene, you know, of that, right, like in the coffee shop when you figure that thing out.
Well, before we get any further with your theater role, since you said you kind of just kind of jumped into the acting part of the theater major, when you wrote prior to college, did you have any non-theater experience?
I mean, not more than a high school kid. You know, I think I won some. Oh, I had my first job was at a newspaper, and they let me do a humor column every week for a while.
I feel like after reading this play, I would like to read that.
Yeah, me too.
I like your sense of humor.
Like, oh my God, it would be super embarrassing. I became a playwright, and I really like school. I teach now, but I really like school. So I did more school. So I did grad school again, cause I'm a sucker. and yeah, so I've been, you know, for the last 10 years, I've been, you know, writing as much as I can, getting produced when I can, self-producing, you know, just doing that writer thing.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned acting as well, because I always like to ask all of my interviewees if they have other, as we like to call them at ERP, any other hats that they wear. So you've already covered writing and acting. Are there any other areas of theater you have gotten your hands wet with that have affected your writing in any way?
Yeah, I mean, this is Philadelphia, you know.
Kind of have to do everything.
We all do everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've directed a little. I've built things. I've hung things. Something I've never done that I really want to do. I don't know. This is a terrible confession for me. I don't know how to work a light board, and I feel like that's a like this secret that I'm walking around with. And I think.
I know how to oper I know how to move from one cue to another for sound and light. And that's about
Okay,
it. I do not know how to
I should
program
say,
a light board. I don't know how to program lights. If someone says go, I know that if I hit this button, the lights will change to the next pretty little thing.
So I guess I haven't done it since college, and I don't think adequately. I've never really designed anything. I've dramaturged.
Wait, it's interesting. I'm sure we've talked about this on this podcast before, but most of the members, both current and founding of Elephant Room Productions, all went to the same university. Most of us went to Bloomsburg University in Pennsylvania, and theirs was a small theater department. So, audition-wise, you weren't exactly getting the most realistic audition room experience because it was pretty much the same 30 people in the department. But you, especially the first year and a half that I was there until they kind of changed the program around a little, you pretty much had to have your hands in everything. Everybody had a practicum assignment where everybody did every load in, every strike. If you weren't in a show, you were running lights, you were ASM, you were sound director, you were SM. So what was neat about that, and I'm sure you got this experience too, just being a Philadelphia-based theater artist, but you know, we had stage managers who would never get cast in a show that got the chance to be on stage. We had actors who, you know, might not necessarily get a lot of time to dress in black moving scenery. So I've personally found that it has definitely helped my outlook on the theatrical world, and it's impacted the jobs that I have been able to accrue because of that background knowledge.
Well, plus, as a playwright, if you write something and then and then somebody says, "Oh, that just can't be done on stage," you know, as a playwright, if you've built sets, you can say, "Oh, yeah, it can. I know it can. This is how you can do it," and they'll hate you, but but you'll be right.
Like getting an airplane into a theater, for example.
There may or may not be a disappearing, reappearing airplane in this play.
Well, before we move on to the play at hand, I just want to ask, since you have pretty since you've landed, since you've known pretty much all along, it sounds like, that writing was kind of the end all be all, has the acting side of it affected the way you've written plays in any way?
Absolutely. I think writing to me feels like an improvisation in my mind where I get to play all of the characters at once, which is the cool feeling about the actual act of writing is just problem solving your way from different perspectives through a scene. And I think there's a big difference between writing from a character's point of view and writing from an outside point of view of the character. And my aesthetic, I think, is to, and not that either one's right or wrong, you know, there's a lot of great work from outside a character's perspective, but I find I'm mostly gratified from writing within a character's perspective, and I think I learned that through acting.
Awesome. Then just to segue into, I guess, what I can call the tentatively titled Girl with Airplane. You'd mentioned before the interview that that name might not be sticking around for much longer.
I have some other ideas. I think we can do better. I don't know, something about courage, or just the original title of the one act version of this play was The Amazing Irene Craig.
Ooh, I like that. In the context of the play, I like that.
All right, there's a vote cast for
Well,
that,
be
so
careful, because as you know, by podcast
I
law,
said it on a podcast.
once it's set on a podcast, it is
It's there
set.
forever.
It is We are done. I don't even know if I need to continue this interview. We're set. We're not here. but that I will get in trouble if I don't continue this interview. So that, and you are also a very interesting parent.
I would be disappointed because I'm having such a good time.
Aww. The nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. So segueing in, can you please set up the kind of basic premise of the play for listeners and then introduce the scene that we're going to be listening to today?
I will try. The play starts with two nonagenarians. Bill and Irene are in their 90s, sitting around a dusty old home eating peas. Bill has held a question in his heart about his wife for the last 40, 50 years. I'm bad at play math, but it's been a long time that he's been wondering this. And today might be the day that he gets up the courage to ask her. He wants to know, is she in fact the legendary aviatrix Amelia Earhart? She is a wily character, so it's hard to get a straight answer out of her, but he contacts an organization that represents the estate of Amelia Earhart, who wants very much to know, are you Amelia Earhart, and is it true that you have the plane that she crashed in? Because both would be very valuable. And this sort of invades her private world. The play asks the question, what would it mean if Amelia Earhart, like the conspiracy theorists held, didn't die, didn't crash in her plane, but had lived through whatever conspiracy theory you're currently subscribing to, had lived and then had settled down to a quiet life, a domestic life, had enjoyed a marriage and a simple way of living, out of the spotlight and out of controversy for the remainder of her life until the 1980s, whenever she would have been very, very old.
That's a whopper.
Yeah.
to digest.
Yeah, it's a weird question that I never meant to ask, but you start writing and you're like, oh, that's weird. Let's go there. Does that get you into the play? I think
it totally does.
Great. All right. Good.
So what scene would you like to share with us today?
I think it's best to start at the beginning.
A very good place to start. See what I did there?
Yeah, we can just do we can just do that play.
Oh, Chris will yell at me because that will be our budget for the year. So in the meantime. Scene one of Girl with Aeroplane. Let's take a listen.
There's something I've been wanting to ask you.
Oh, for goodness sake.
I've wanted to ask you something for a very long time.
Get it over with, then.
A very long time.
You don't say.
Years.
I wish you wouldn't say.
Decades.
I'd wish you'd not say anything ever again.
Ever since I've known you, Irene, I've been dying to ask you one question.
Well, what is it then? What is your big question? Ask it. At last and finally, after nearly 50 years of marital bliss, uncover the true nature of my soul, so that you can finally stop bugging me with these ridiculous interrogations. Ask whatever question it is that haunts you. Ask it already.
I don't know if now's the right time.
It's never the right time.
I may die without ever having asked you this question.
Ask the damn question so that before I die, I can eat my peas in peace.
It's a big question.
It certainly must be.
When I requested your hand all those years ago, I had intended on asking you this question.
Must be a big question.
But I lost my nerve, so I proposed marriage instead.
You were more interesting in those days.
I can't ask it. I haven't the courage.
I am going to shit in your therapeutic loafers if you do not get this ridiculous business done once and for all.
You'll do it, too.
I'm in amazement.
Okay.
Ask me.
Here it comes.
Take the plunge.
Are you Amelia Earhart?
What did you say?
Are you actually the legendary aviatrix Amelia Earhart?
You are mentally disabled.
I've always suspected...
That I was...
That you were...
Amelia Earhart.
The aviatrix.
Who died in the Pacific Ocean.
That's the one.
Are you impaired due to stroke?
Do you deny it?
Yes!
Will you look me in the eyes and deny it?
Of course I deny it. It's preposterous.
Do you swear that you are not, nor have you ever been, Amelia Earhart?
I do.
You're lying to me.
I'm going to shit in your loafers anyway.
They still haven't found the body.
The Pacific Ocean is very large.
There were reports of messages broadcast from a tiny island called Nikumaroru.
She died.
She may have survived.
I don't give a damn about any of this. I'm not her.
I know about your aeroplane.
What aeroplane is this?
You had an aeroplane years ago.
I have never in my whole life had an aeroplane.
In 1952, I had the crazy notion in my head that you were having an affair with my brother. I would phone home from the bank, and you wouldn't answer. So one day, I took the binoculars with me and told work I wouldn't be in. I waited down the street in the Ford for you to leave. You did. You rode your bicycle for miles and miles. I had to stop the car when you went down a little mud path covered with brush. I followed you on foot from a cool distance, and what I saw confirmed those old suspicions. There was an old aeroplane in a barn. You swung the door open and walked in. I was terrified of being seen, so I left. You can't deny that you had an aeroplane.
You're right.
I knew it.
I was indeed having an affair with your brother.
That's not true.
He found that old barn with some beat-up old crop duster for our rendezvous. We would sit in the cockpit and do all kinds of animalistic adultery. And that's the secret. You sensed I had a secret all those years, and, well, I did. I'm not proud of it, but I just wasn't cut out to sit around a home and make modest American love to a modest American man. I lusted, Bill. And your brother was the beneficiary of that lust. And I really do apologize that all these years you thought I was secretly someone else. Some amazing someone else. Amelia Earhart, of all people. The unfortunate truth is I'm just your boring old wife. Though perhaps a little more promiscuous than you thought.
I know better than that.
You don't know anything at all.
I know you and Fred Noonan were really sent to the Pacific by the United States government in your Lockheed Electra to spy on the Japs.
Please don't refer to them as the Japs.
I married Amelia Earhart, the most incredible woman of the 20th century. I know who I married. No one is going to tell me I didn't marry Amelia Earhart.
Was she incredible?
Oh, she was. You were the one who changed the world. Little girls saw your achievements and knew they could rise above the Barbie dolls, the petticoats, and become an explorer. You put a loop around the world and tightened it like a girdle that you would never wear. And the world shrank down to size. You are Amelia Earhart. You are amazing, and I love you.
You really think quite a lot of Amelia Earhart, don't you?
Yes.
You're wrong.
I'm right.
You're wrong.
I'm exactly right, and I know I am.
It was the British government that hired myself and Fred. We landed in the Marshall Islands, not Nikumaroro. The Brits faked the broadcasts. No one has ever found the plane because they're not looking in that little barn several miles from town. I cut my left thigh shaving my leg for an interview. Newspapers were infinitely more dangerous to me than an aeroplane.
You are an amazement.
Thank you, Bill. Now eat your damn peas.
I will eat my peas.
Take you for a ride later?
Ha!
And we're back. So, you don't waste any time jumping right into it.
Yeah.
Which I will say that was one of my favorite parts of reading this piece. It was just that line of, are you the legendary Amelia Earhart? What? So, also, odd timing of us recording this, but about a week ago was when I recorded episode 16, and the play of that episode was about the legendary paleontologist Mary Anning, and we had a the playwright and I had a long discussion about the challenges of writing a historical character and writing what's essentially a true story. This is slightly different, I've noticed, whereas you've kind of blended those. You're writing about, in essence, a real person, but the characterization of her, the characterization of Irene specifically, is very unique to this piece. So,
sure.
However, not to give too much away about the play, but we do see a younger Amelia with other historical figures as well.
Oh my God, you have to. It's too tempting, yeah.
Well, the only reason I bring it up was I was wondering, was there a challenge in writing, essentially, you had basically two different approaches to writing Amelia Earhart. You had the, you know, this is her in history interacting with these people versus the, you know, what if she was, like you said before the scene, you know, what if she had settled down? What if she has this, you know, domestic lifestyle?
Sure.
So was that a challenge at all, kind of flipping between those characterizations, or did it feel more like, more or less like you were writing the same character?
So that's a really cool question. So when I accidentally started doing a bunch of research, you know, when you fall into like an internet hole that becomes a documentary hole that becomes, I ended up reading this book that's to this day one of my favorite books, East to the Dawn, which is just a really, really great study of Amelia Earhart's life. That it was very clear in that book that no one really knew Amelia Earhart. That she very consciously created a media persona, and that she was to certain people who she needed to be, and I mean, in the same way that nobody ever knows the whole true shining light of another human being, but the Amelia Earhart, the Lucky Strike cigarettes got, and the Amelia Earhart that her students got, and the Amelia Earhart that, you know, she was a lot of different things. And to that degree, any famous person is so many different things.
I think, not to get off track, but I think we learned that in 2017.
Yes, yeah.
sorry to be awkward, but...
Well, awkward, but, I mean, we learned a lot about that for worse, but I think it's true for better and for lateral as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But the... She really didn't like, or didn't seem to embrace the limelight, personally, but recognized it as, something that she could manipulate to do good. And that was one of the things that was really fascinating to me about her. And that's, there are scenes where she's, in this fantasy world, she is pestering Eleanor Roosevelt to do more, and is sort of Eleanor Roosevelt's spirit animal in some weird way, that she's constantly saying, Eleanor, you can do this, do it. Of course, this is all untrue. But I think when you look at a historical biography, you know, everything's untrue. And
right.
And so the what I was interested in was the there were so many and still are so many conspiracy theories about the disappearance of this amazing woman. And I wondered why we need that. Like, why we need, I mean, I guess it's because it's a story that we don't get the benefit of the end of.
Right.
When she disappears, like, show us exactly what happened, and we didn't get to see that. But there seems to be a need to tell this story that, no, she was a spy for the British government, and she went to Japan and infiltrated their, you know, just the, like this. So so we start with, of course she's not, I mean, I personally don't believe that she lived. I also don't necessarily, there is a story that she may or may not have given flying lessons to Eleanor Roosevelt, but you know, so much
which
is fabricated.
Is also an interesting scene to see.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that any sort of responsibility we have to journalistic integrity is countered by the responsibility that we have to dramatic integrity. So, I mean, I think it's really important to allow this to be a play and allow it to be fantastical. And particularly with a person who is a very important person in the history of our culture, but at the same time, someone who is so mysterious and elusive both during her life and probably after her life as well. I think the wondering is also important.
Nice. So I guess the next thing I want to ask is, especially since I'm doing two interviews back to back with real world inspiration, was what was the most unique thing you learned about her that you had not known before that may have helped, which may have helped how to develop Irene?
Oh, okay. I've never written a play where I threw away so many scenes. just because, like, so much, you know, I got so much great information, and part of it was, oh shoot, I forgot. I'm gonna sound stupid. Gore Vidal's father. He was a legislator, and involved in the. Yeah, Jean Vidal. So she had an affair, or likely had an affair, with Jean Vidal.
Oh.
There is a great story that actually did make its way into this draft of the play, where little Gore Vidal was in her house, and she had a room where Gore Vidal stayed that was dressed up like, there, that was decorated like the jungle, and he was afraid of it. And she told her that the reason I painted, she told the Gore Vidal that the reason I painted this, like little Gore Vidal, the reason I painted this room like this is because I'm afraid of the jungle too, and it helps me confront my fear. And I'm like, whoa, that is amazing. The other thing that amazed me was, this story was in some biography I read. She wore men's underwear when flying. George Palmer, yeah, her husband believed that they were his underwear, and they might have been. But the reason she wore men's underwear was because on very long flights, it was easier to pee.
Yeah,
wearing women's. I don't know if you can put that in your podcast or not, but I.
Oh, I've had worse.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just thought that was sort of like, I mean, it reminds me, because when I fly, my God, I get nervous, and I have to get up twice on a short flight to use the bathroom. But like, it reminds me of how, like, oh, you're not, like, you know, at this time, they weren't flying like we think of flying. They were, like, yeah. in these,
they were literally,
like,
flying.
Yeah, these little metal tubes, sometimes, like, early on with her face in the clouds, like,
It's a very beautiful speech she gives early on about the have you ever looked down at a cloud?
Yeah.
That moment.
Yeah, flying.
Well, I am very, very interested to hear what our New York end of things thinks of this play. I think that your sense of humor is very funny. One more thing I want to address about the play before we wrap up is I admire your riskiness in putting a nude 92-year-old man in a scene.
Yeah.
So you got to do what you got to do, man. Like,
yeah. There's something that really moves me about old people who still want to have sex with each other.
It's beautiful.
That sounded terrible. No, but I think there's something really beautiful about, I wrote a kind of a play that never got produced, never got read. Nothing ever happened with this play, about an elderly couple, like, years before this one, that focused more on that. But, there's just something, that really moves me, the romantic in me. Aww. And, you know, about the sexual life of 92-year-old people. I don't know what that is. I can't imagine it. And, I mean, I'm probably as wrong about that experience as I am about every other experience in this play. But still, I think it's kind of beautiful regardless. So it's there.
Well, thank you so, so much for chatting with me about Girl with Airplane. To kind of bring it down a bit, I always like to wrap up my interviews with a fun theater question. And as I promised on the last episode, I will finally do new questions than the same couple that I've been repeating over and over. Just as kind of a neat, unique for these questions, a non-drinking question, because usually I say, what character would you like to drink with? But if you could rewrite any scene or character from a play with your own point of view, which would you pick?
Wow.
No worries.
You know what? Like, the first thing that's coming to mind, so why not talk about it, is I think about this play from time to time, Clybourne Park by Bruce Norris. Going deep into the history of theater. I'm really intrigued by this play, but I want to reverse the act. So I guess that's not really a character thing, though.
No, that's unique. I said outcome as well. Yeah.
The second act is just so dangerous and alive, and the second act as it is just compares to, it pales in comparison to what they're going through, to the danger. And anyway, I'd just like to see it reversed. That's not a character thing at all. I failed at answering your question, but that's the first thing that came to my mind.
No, that's incredible. And it's inspired me to think of more creative questions in the future.
And now somebody's going to, like, write me a dirty email about, like, how dare you, sir?
Well, you'll probably also be getting emails about your opinions on old people having sex.
I'm open to those emails. Please.
On that note, Davey, thank you so, so much for chatting with me today. And
thank you. This has been fun.
Airplane. All right.
Thank you.
Well, hopefully you have to catch up soon.
All right. Sounds great.
Bye.
Bye.
And next up, I am speaking with Philadelphia-based actress, director, and playwright, and very good friend of mine, Lisa Villamil, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is very exciting.
And in a little bit, we will be talking about our recent Philly Ears reading of her play Salamander. But first off, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your theater history?
Okay. Well, I have been a professional actor now for a little while. Most of my education is in acting. I have my master's in acting from the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland.
Ooh.
I know, it's so exotic. I particularly like Shakespeare. My undergraduate degree was in English literature, so I imagine that that's sort of how I came to writing. Just a merge of English lit and acting.
Well, I always, as has been said more times than me saying on this podcast, I always talk about different theatrical hats. And as I personally led with, you have a lot of them. What would you say is your primary focus as a theater professional?
Right now it's acting. But that's because I work at the Hedgerow Theater, and I've been employed there as an actor, and it takes up a lot of my time.
Well, how did you first break into the theater world as a youngin'? What was the first area you jumped into? Was it acting?
The first thing I did was acting. When I was a sophomore in high school, I saw this poster in the hallways for Into the Woods audition, and I had no idea what Into the Woods was. But I thought, I'm going to go audition for that. And I'd never sung, but I went in and I sang one of the songs, and they cast me as Rapunzel, and I was...
I could see you as Rapunzel.
Oh, man, I was so scared because...
You know, Into the Woods is actually, I think, a really good metaphor for going into the theater world, because it starts out really light and fun and exciting, and you think, this is fine, and then you realize, oh, this is a lot deeper than I thought it was. But that doesn't mean there can't be a happy ending. There's just going to be bumps along the way.
This is so, so true. But I was in this tower. I was in this tower constructed by these 16 and 17-year-old boys every night, and I could feel it shaking. And so it was a horrifying experience. But obviously something about it stuck with me, because here I am still acting. Go figure.
You got it. So... as I ask anybody who has a million hats on, let's focus on your playwriting, but also to speak to your directing. How has your experience in the other areas of theater influenced or shaped or changed the way you approach other aspects of theater?
Well, so far I've only really directed children's shows. And as I tend to write pieces that are quite adult in nature, that's maybe not the right word, that makes them sound... like licentious or something, but things that are a bit more mature.
I'm picturing a group of our Hedgerow students from my creative camps doing like Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross.
Right.
Like, coffee is for closers. Like.
Yeah. At any rate. So I don't know that directing so much has influenced anything. However, I do know that when I've worked with directors, it's more fun when the script is completely open and you can do anything, right? There's this idea in the theatrical world that the playwright is God. Anything that is committed to the page, you do. You don't cut it, you don't change it, you don't omit anything, you don't add anything. And if there is a stage direction in there, by God, you do it, right? But now... we're moving into this world where things are a bit more open. Black box theater is becoming a lot bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Interpersonal drama is becoming a lot bigger. And so at least with my writing now, I'm trying to explore this idea of never putting stage directions in so that directors can do whatever and actors can.
Which I saw is, you know, we'll speak to it when we get to Salamander, but I saw that in the play that it did give a lot of, it gave a lot more room for you to think. Basically.
Right. Well, I like the idea of, I use an ellipses to signify action.
Yeah.
And it's just an indication of, you should put some action here. I don't care what it is. It can be someone having the hiccups. It can be someone fainting. It can be someone like throwing a birthday party. I really don't care. But there has to be some sort of action here that moves the plot forward, right?
Right. And it's funny because, you know, you think about black box theater and in the old stereotypical sense that it was, you know, every college theater program has a black box, and you know, for many, many years, a black box production was, well, we're doing the real show over here, let's do our little other project here. And I really like that it's kind of, you know, moved. Like, when I was in school, I definitely saw that shift because our artistic director, Lauren M. Shover, took on a production completely on her own with no faculty guidance, really, other than kind of like some here and there touch bases about things. And we did a one act production that was this beautiful piece, the way it was staged with, it was basically two rooms, but one space divided by a table. It was incredible. So I like that beyond the college scape, we're seeing more and more of that, especially in the Philadelphia scene.
Oh yeah. It's really coming into its own. I mean, that makes it sound like it hasn't been around for ages,
right?
But it's almost like it's getting more respect now. It's being seen as on an even keel with some of these bigger productions that have lots of faffing about going on stage, right?
Yeah.
But it's kind of nice to remove everything, remove props, remove any specific standing set, and just let the acting happen.
Right.
Or just let the words happen.
Well, Tony, also, like you mentioned earlier, and I am totally in agreement of this, your love of Shakespeare. And pretty much, like, if you are a purist and you are going to do every word on the page and every stage direction exactly how it's written, you're not going to have a successful Shakespeare show nowadays. I mean, and I think that's always been the case. I mean, there's a reason that Shakespeare will never stop being performed, because there is no limit to what you can do with it. You can, I forget what it was. We talked about it on a recent episode of like putting, you know, let's put King Lear in space or something like that. Why not? There's no specific. Actually, no, that was a Facebook post. It was like, there's no specificity. It's like the only, which is funny, the only Shakespeare play that has a specific stage direction is Winter's Tale, I think.
Except because by a bear.
Yeah. Which even that is like, is it a panda bear? Is it a polar bear? You
Ooh,
decide.
Wow.
Okay, sidebar.
Yeah.
Let's do a production of Winter's Tale where it's a polar bear.
What if we changed it up every night? So not every night.
A different bear.
There's a different kind of bear.
I don't know what our budget is for bear costumes or actual bears. Yo, let's get an actual bear. I'm seeing the holes in this process as I'm pitching it, but you know what? We're doers.
Okay, we are doers. Yeah, we achieve. achieve.
So moving on from bears, because that's my favorite subject, let's just shift on to a different type of animal, the salamander.
Ooh.
To talk about your play,
what
Salamander.
What a transition.
I know. I'm great at them, normally. We're going to feature a little scene before we talk about it. But first, can you just give a brief description of Salamander to kind of set up the play for our listeners, and then give a description of what scene we're going to be listening to?
I can try. So Salamander is a story about three women in particular and how their lives start to intersect based on their interactions with this one male character, conveniently called Male. As the events of the plot go on, you start to notice more and more how women are downtrodden in the script and how they are disrespected, and eventually that starts to change them into something. And initially it's thought to be this virus, but ultimately it's just a surrealist identity that they start to take on, where they are not women anymore, but they're also not really anything.
Right.
They're just blank canvases. They're nothing. They have no hair. They have no color. They have no feelings. They have nothing to them, right? And the idea is sort of that that's how they can be safe in this world that is dangerous to them because of the interactions they share with men. In this scene, what is happening is that Male has been thrown out of a strip club on his birthday, and he has come across Girl in an alley who has seen him kind of bruised up from his exit, and she has asked if he's okay. He's sort of taken this opportunity to woo her a little bit and ask her out to a bar, and so this scene is the interactions that they have while they are sitting in that bar.
All right, let's take a listen.
Another?
Yeah,
For the both of us.
I really shouldn't.
Relax, it's on me.
Two?
Yeah, thanks.
I just have pretty poor tolerance is all.
So do I. Allegedly, this is the way to solve that problem.
Is it a problem?
Aren't you in college? Yeah, it's a problem.
The bar is fine. Nearly empty. There aren't a lot of students here, and certainly none that I recognize.
And tonight, two found dead at a campground near Beecham. Drug use suspected. Later. Cell phone use and mental illness. The surprising connection that might be affecting your children.
So, what about you?
Hmm?
You go to the university, you study, what, you know? I mean, what do you do?
Music.
Oh, yeah?
I'm there on a scholarship in the band and all that.
What do you play?
Clarinet.
Cool, yeah. When I was a kid, I played recorder. What?
That's not a real instrument, sorry.
Here you go.
Thanks. What do you mean? It makes music. I played, what was it, like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and shit.
Calling a recorder an instrument is like calling color by numbers art.
Why is that?
No one actually plays the recorder. It's a starter thing to get 7-year-olds used to moving their fingers about, start thinking about breath control.
Well, I was the best recorder player in my grade, I'll have you know.
At 16, I was the best teen woodwind player in the state of Pennsylvania.
All right, so you're cooler than me.
Well, cool is a relative term. What?
You're cute.
Breaking news tonight. As the first instance of what people are calling the Barbie virus has appeared in West Virginia, leading to a panic quelled by local authorities.
I just want my daughter to be healthy again. We want our little girl back.
More after the break.
You are. I know, so awkward. A compliment. God.
It is, kind of.
Why? I mean, explain this to me, okay? I really don't understand it. Why is it awkward when a guy says something nice to a girl?
I just wasn't expecting it.
Nah, that's not it.
It's like if I say, thank you, I'm agreeing with you, which means I'm, I guess, arrogant, like I have a high opinion of myself.
Why would that be a bad thing?
I don't know.
I have a high opinion of myself.
Oh?
I'm confident. I think I'm attractive, sure. I think I'm reasonably well educated. Is that a turnoff for you?
No.
Is it a turn on?
I don't know.
Oh, got here.
Yeah, kind of. Confidence, yeah, confidence is a bit of a turn on.
Well, same thing in women.
Okay.
So?
Yeah.
I think you're cute.
Good.
And I think you're sexy.
Thank you.
I think I'd like to take you back to my
house. How old are you?
What?
How old are you? Your birthday?
24.
Close to that quarter life crisis, huh?
Is that a real thing?
Supposedly.
Well, I'm feeling just fine, thank you. No crisis here.
So, like, where are you going in life?
Where am I going?
Like, your career. Like, where do you live?
My career? I work in a grocery store.
Well, what do you want to do?
Move, I guess. Move to New York. Is that cliche? That's cliche.
No, I get it. I kind of want to, too. I just haven't graduated yet.
Right.
Well, what do you want to do?
Make money. Meet a ton of people. Be generally... I don't know. It's stupid.
What?
That's stupid.
Okay.
I want to be fucking fascinating. I want people to see me and want to be me or know me or just want to set the world on fire and watch it burn.
So you think destruction makes you fascinating?
Jesus, I don't know what this is. What is this, a philosophy lesson? Christ.
No, I'm sorry.
No, it's whatever. Whatever. I mean, what do you want to do? Teach?
What makes you say that?
Music, the arts. Teaching seems like what people do. Am I wrong?
I mean, a lot of musicians actually play music. It's surprising, I know.
That wasn't meant to insult you.
Yeah, though I've spent like $200,000 on this education so far, so I think, yeah, maybe I will give up my dreams and pass on my knowledge into kids who want to learn how to play the recorder. That sounds good.
You know, that's not what I meant. To whatever it is you want to do in your life, I have no doubt you'll succeed. And I'm sorry for insulting you. Cheers.
Cheers.
And we're back. So, first off, In contrast to the first play we talked about in this episode, the Girl with Airplane was kind of... farcical is not the right word, but it was a much lighter tone because you weren't here for the first half of the record. And if our listeners need a refresher from about, I think it's about 16 minutes ago, Girl with Airplane was the whimsical story of what if Amelia Earhart had survived and settled down and was Ooh. Now in a relationship.
Oh, that's cool.
It's incredible. It's very funny.
That sounds like a lot more fun than when I brought you.
Yes. So, as a tone shift, this one, while not devoid of humor, there were it seems to be a theme with, you know, most well-written pieces is no matter how, you know, dark or serious or pivotal the subject matter is, there's still always room for humor. This one definitely takes a more serious tone. So I guess I'd like to ask, because I've not gotten the chance to look at more of your work, is this the style you generally tend to write in, or do you have a preferred genre?
I've been a bit all over the place lately. This play, Salamander, came at the end of two sorts of other things that I was writing, one of which was I was sort of foraying into surreal pieces, right. Surreal drama, and the other being Violence Against Women, which I'd written a couple short plays on that theme because I hadn't quite figured out what I wanted to say about it yet. And Salamander is sort of the culmination of both of those things, this surreal train of thought that I was on, and also this, you know, what do we do with this, how women are treated in this world right now, what do we do with this? So they came together. So in that sense, it's sort of the only piece I've written that is of its ilk. But generally speaking, I guess I do stick to things that are a lot more serious in nature. I'm not a terribly funny person.
Oh, that's a lie, and I know that's a lie.
Whatever.
But no, like I said, this was an incredibly moving and powerful piece.
Thank you.
Coincidentally read at the table that we are recording at right now.
Comes full circle.
I know, always. So what was the main inspiration behind this specific piece?
So I said before I was kind of on that train of thought with Violence Against Women. About, I want to say, 6 months before I started writing Salamander, I wrote this 10-minute piece called Hearsay that was about two friends on a college campus having a conversation, one being a girl and one being a guy. And the girl is saying, "What did you do over the weekend? Because I've heard some things," right? And the idea being that perhaps he had in some way sexually assaulted another student, right? And that sort of happened because I had had a similar experience in college where someone had not assaulted me or anything, but not really understood the word no very well. Mm-hmm. And later on when I was talking about it with a mutual friend of ours, he kind of shrugged it off. Like, oh, well, that's just so-and-so. And something about that interaction has always chilled me. How dismissive it was. And so I guess Salamander sort of grew out of this, how can you be so dismissive when someone tells you a problem has just happened? How can you not believe, particularly a woman, when she says that your friend got a bit forceful last night and wouldn't listen to the word no. And then Brock Turner happened, right?
Yeah.
And then he got let out early on parole. And people don't seem to think he's as much of a predator as, whatever, a drug dealer.
Right.
Which is just blows my mind. But even there were things when I was looking up this Brock Turner case, there's a conversation that is you can read where one of his female friends is describing, well, Brock, you know, people in college get drunk, but he's not a rapist. A rapist is someone who waits for you in a parking lot and grabs you, but he was drunk, so it didn't count. This is a female friend of his.
Yeah.
And just the weight with which we give to men's words over women's words really unsettled me. So I guess all of that sort of bled into what Salamander became.
Well, that kind of reminds me of, you know, not to go too deep into the pit that was what we learned about male celebrities in 2017, but yeah. I remember that there was Samantha Bee had an amazing take on that after the whole Aziz Ansari incident happened, which I know ruffled a lot of feathers based on he apologized, I think he did the right thing, he owned up that he mm-hmm. Was in the wrong. And Samantha Bee's argument was, no, what he did was not as bad as some of the previous people, but there should be a better standard than that. There's, you can say, yes, what he did was wrong, and it's also not okay.
Yes.
So what I thought was really compelling about this piece, just to speak to the dismissiveness aspect, was the two characters, the John and Jane, who encompass the every man, every woman aspect. So basically the character breakdown is you have those specific characters that you mentioned earlier, and then every other character in the play is one actor or one actress.
Yes.
Flipping in and out. And I will say, when we first started reading it, there was it took us about a page to kind of see that, and I think it was because of the lack of stage directions,
right?
Which is, by the way, not a criticism. It worked very, very well. it was just funny because when we were reading it, Lauren started the mom monologue, just seeing Jane kind of as the previous scenes, Jane, and then realized, oh, no, it's the mom. I gotta change the energy.
Yeah.
Which I think is it's an incredible challenge for a performer to have all of those characters in their yeah. head. Some of them are only in one scene. Some of them come back.
Some of them only have four lines.
Exactly.
Some of them have a whole monologue.
Some of them are different characters in the same scene.
Yeah.
So what was your thought in keeping all of those characters relegated to two people? Two performers, I should say.
Wanting theaters to produce my work.
That's a fair answer. Some of the questions are easy.
No, but also there is something nice about having... I liked the idea of having Jane and John have a scene of their own at the end that mirrors the bar scene that yeah. was had at the beginning. And I liked the idea that they had, whether it was them playing other characters or not, that they had played other characters and been around all of uh-huh. this the entire time, just so that as an audience member, you get the idea that the world is imbued with this crap.
Right.
We walk through it all the time, and a lot of times we ignore right. it. I mean, Jane plays the bartender.
It's a really powerful speech.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, she's serving drinks to the two of these people, right?
Right.
She's a woman, and she must see what's going on, that this guy is getting this girl drunk. She must see it. But she keeps doing it. You know what I mean?
And she has this beautiful speech that I was very, very moved by, where she's essentially in her head speaking to male, saying like, I see this.
Oh,
why
it's not even speaking to male. I know it's confusing. Everyone says that, but it's confusing.
Okay.
That is just her talking to someone. I don't care who.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be talking to male. Because she's never really had any sort of interaction with him. Same thing, John has a monologue later that's completely out of nowhere. It's mostly because I wanted to steal lines from them.
Right.
And
right.
throw them into the end of Act One so that we had this cacophony of lines going.
Which I pictured and was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. So also the staging of it seems really interesting. I said in the last episode that the sign of a good play is when I'm reading it, I can't tell right away how I would stage it. And that, I think to me, that is a sign that a play is worthwhile.
Oh, good.
So what I love about this is that you have taken away every crutch that a director would fall on in blocking, in terms of like a full, you know, Davey was talking about earlier in this episode, or actually before we recorded, just the idea of like putting a couch on stage, where actors are just going to sit on the couch and then you kind of lose them depending on how the couch is orientated. Yeah. But by having this kind of, you know, free space and just giving the director the trust to say, these are my words, you do the rest from there.
Yeah.
It's horrifying for a director, but like I said, worthwhile.
I am a very firm believer that the play is one thing when I write it, and then it becomes another thing when everyone else gets involved. Then it's a new thing that I don't have control over.
Yeah.
But so help me God, you better not change my words.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's up to you. I mean, you can fill it in however you want. If you want to add a crowd in the back that never talks, do that. I don't care. You want to put it underwater, that's fine. King Lear in space. Yeah, exactly.
But it's going to be the name of this episode, I can tell.
But I've picked the words very carefully, so I want the words to be upheld. That's all. But otherwise, yeah, do whatever you want. I think it's fun. I talked to this playwright once, Douglas Maxwell, in Scotland, because that's where I went to school. And he liked to put these things into scripts that he would call FUs to the director. Yeah. So things
like Martin McDonagh.
Yeah, pretty much. But things like, one in particular that he's done is a 16-foot-tall pterodactyl descends from the ceiling. That's the stage direction. That's it. And it's just like, well, F you, director. Figure it out. I don't have to because I just wrote it.
Well, it's actually funny you bring that up, because once again, to call back to the first half of this episode, Girl with Airplane features an airplane. More than once.
So. Right? So it's like, put an airplane on stage. Have fun. Bye.
So another contrast from the first half of the interview, or the first half of this episode, was Girl with Airplane. The interview was recorded prior to the ears reading, and this interview is being recorded after the ears reading. So I can ask, was the feedback helpful in shaping the piece to another place you wanted to take it?
Yeah, a lot of the feedback was very helpful. And some of it was things that I already suspected and I just couldn't pull the trigger on. Like, ooh, I think her development's a little weak. I should probably give her a bit more of a rounded off thing at the end. So, yes, a lot of it was very, very helpful. And, you know, it's nice. Even though it was a first read, and so people maybe didn't totally get what was going on until you guys got into the script, I've never heard it out loud before. And that is essential to building a good script. You have to hear it, because plays are supposed to be heard.
Right.
You know?
And I think of all the pieces that we've done for ears, because of the lack of specific direction and setting and stage direction that you included with it, I think is probably translated the best to audio.
I imagine that.
So how did not being present for the feedback compare to other readings you've been a part of?
I actually think it was good. I have previously, particularly when I was in school, I had a whole host of actors around all the time because it was, you know, a master's acting degree.
Right.
So there were, you know, 19 other people I could go to just in my class alone, right?
Right.
But they were nice, you know? Yeah. And your feedback was totally nice, too. It was presented in a very professional manner. None of it was like, you suck, never write again, or like, haha, your script is so funny and bad. None of it was like that. But it was just...
I don't see how anyone could read the script and have that reaction.
Oh, well, I'm sure people do. But this was just unhindered, right? Because I wasn't there. People felt, it seemed to me, just reading what was given back to me, felt willing to say, yeah, I didn't really get this bit, which I don't think... If I was sitting in the room, many people would have felt 100% comfortable doing.
Right.
They might hint at things, but they won't fully say it. You know what I mean?
No, totally. Well, Lisa, thank you so, so much for sharing this piece with us. It was incredibly moving, tough to get through at certain points because of certain things that happen in the piece. But it's, you know, we said this at the feedback, and I'll just say it here on the record, it's producible at this point.
Oh, thank you so much. What, needs one more draft.
Yeah, that's fine. And, you know, you kind of led into it with a little bit of a, it has a minor sci-fi element to it with the quote-unquote virus.
Sure. I like to call it surreal.
Right.
I like to call it surreal.
But the reason I bring that up is that it didn't take me out of the reality of the problems that you are highlighting in it.
Yeah.
And I think that it very much works in this day and age, and it's very much a play that I think needs to be heard by people.
Oh, thank you so much.
So to lighten things up for the end, I always end my interviews with a fun little theater question. And just like keeping up the trend with Davey, I'm not going to ask a drinking-based question.
Thank you.
I actually have a question that I have been working on for you, and I'm really excited to hear your answer
so
for
excited.
It.
I'm excited, okay.
So one of the main themes of this play, I guess you would say, is the role that women and men play in society, the relationship and the kind of dominance, I guess, not the best word, but the role that some women feel in comparison to men. So, if you could take any character from any piece and reverse the gender,
oh my God,
which piece would you pick and why?
Oh, man. Okay. Wow, this is a big one.
Yeah.
This is a big one.
Just to let you know, I do have editing capability, so you can take as much time as you want.
Okay, you give me a hot sec here, because I have a thought that immediately came to mind, but...
Oh, fantastic.
No, I want to just make sure that that's, you know, that's my answer. Oh, man. Okay. I would say, I'm going to say the name, and I hope I don't make you cringe because you're a theater person.
Okay, go ahead.
I would change Macbeth to a woman because I think, number one, I'd really like to play it.
Yes.
And number two, the whole play, right, is kind of about this masculinity. And about constantly, it's being thrown at him, are you a man, are you a man, are you a man?
Yeah.
Right? And I just think it would be interesting to sort of switch that up a bit and give a woman that role who is already thought to be less powerful, right? And then try and have Lady M build her up, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to say, would you reverse Lady M as well? But I actually very much like the idea of having Lady M still be Lady M.
Because then the play sort of becomes about women overtaking men. And that's just kind of interesting to me.
All right, we're going to make it happen.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for reading my play.
Absolutely.
The feedback was great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in, Lisa. And that's all we have for this month. Just remember, if you have a play to send to us, please, please send it to erpsubmissions@gmail.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so join our elephant herd today. Until next time, this is Robert Gene Pelleccio, signing off.
That was a really good pun.
Thank you.